Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the difference between college students who finish their education and those who leave school without a diploma? While the number of American high school graduates that go on to college has more than doubled over the past four decades, nearly half of those students will fail to earn a degree within 6 years. Colleges and universities are well aware of the problem, but as my guest today will tell us, many continue to back the same prevention programs year after year, despite growing evidence that other strategies would be far more effective. Vincent Tinto is distinguished professor in the School of Education at Syracuse University. His new book is called Completing College, Rethinking Institutional Action. Vincent, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
So nearly half of students who enroll in college don't have a degree within 6 years, at a time when a lot of Americans, and Americans as a whole, now owe more student debt than credit card debt. That adds up to a lot of wasted time and also money.
Yes, it does, Chris. Nevertheless, the evidence is those who complete college over their lifetimes earn considerably more than those who do not. Hmm. So even though there is debt, it still, in effect, pays to go to college and complete college.
And it's also interesting that we have managed to narrow the gap between high and low income students who make it to college. But the gap in terms of economics is widening for those who finish.
That's right, Chris. It is quite startling and disappointing that though the gap in access between high and low income students has decreased over the past several years, the gap in completion of four-year degrees has actually increased. Now, there's a number of reasons for this, but not the least of which is that we've been unable to effectively address the needs of low-income students. For instance, while students who come from high-income backgrounds who start college graduate with some degree at a rate of almost 60%, for low-income students, only about 25% are able to earn any sort of degree after 6 years. That difference is really quite startling and unacceptable, Chris.
And the problem can't be only that the low-income students run out of money and the high-income students can pay. Can you talk about some of the other differences between them and their lives?
Well, there's many differences, of course. The disproportionate number of low-income students struggle before they get to college. They live in poor areas. They often attend schools, elementary, middle, and high schools, who simply do not prepare them well for college. So we know that a disproportionate number of these low-income students begin college academically underprepared. And that's why, you know, it's important to argue that access without appropriate support does not provide real opportunity to these students. So increasingly, a number of colleges are starting to ask themselves, what sort of support do these low-income students need to provide them reasonable opportunities to complete their degrees?
How do risk factors differ, Vincent, depending on whether students live on campus or they commute to school?
It's a very important question, Chris. The fact is most low-income students work, they commute, and often attend part-time. And for these students in particular, but not only, when they come to campus, the first place they go to is the classroom. Mm-hmm. And when class is over, they leave. They tend to families, work, or other obligations. And therefore, if we don't reach these students and provide appropriate support while they're in the classroom, they don't succeed. So one of the things that institutions are now starting to realize is that though institutions have invested a considerable amount of money and resources in retention programs, they have not yet addressed the classroom experience. Classroom experience for students is very much like it's been for the last 50, 60 years. Students sit passively in the classroom. For them, learning is a spectator sport, and there's no real engagement. And those are the things that we must change if we really want to address the needs of these students, and in fact, all students.
And those lecture-based courses, particularly in the early years, may be very different from what students had been used to in high school classrooms.
Well, that's true. You know, the irony of this, Chris, is that whereas elementary, middle, and high school teachers are trained and certified to teach, as a matter of prior practice and preparation, we in higher education, our faculty, are literally not trained. Hmm. This is not to say that there are not many talented and devoted faculty who do wonders in the classroom. But as a matter of practice, we are the only educators in education who come to the task of teaching students who had literally not trained to do so.
I guess the idea historically has been you know your subject so well that you will have no problem communicating it. I mean, do you find that a lot of university professors bristle at the suggestion that maybe they take a couple of courses in strategies and methods of education?
Yes and no. I mean, the position a lot of faculty members face is one of multiple tensions. You know, in many universities really promote research and publication.
Right.
And so they argue, fine, you know, we spend more time on teaching, but if we don't do our research articles or get grants, we are not tenured. Conversely, those faculty members in the community colleges often teach 15 hours a week, if not more.
Hmm.
And they would say, when do we find time to address these questions? But there is some hope. A number of colleges, increasingly two-year colleges, for example, Richland College in the Dallas Community College District, right by you, Chris, they now require, as a condition of first contract, all new faculty members to spend 2 years together in what is called a faculty learning community to actually learn about teaching methods, cooperative teaching. They learn about assessment methods. They learn about student learning theories and learning development. And they are, in effect, seriously taking the task of training teachers to teach.
Now, you say learning communities. This is actually something that comes up in the book that can be applied to students themselves. Can you talk a little bit about what these are and how they work?
Yeah, thank you, Chris. The primary principle of a learning community is that students learn better together. That is to say, when students are actively involved with other students in the classroom, they spend more time engaged in learning, they spend more time studying, and in turn, they learn more and succeed more. Now, a learning community takes that notion and applies it to several courses. So a learning community for students requires them to register for two or more classes in a semester. And in doing so, the faculty members or the people who teach those linked courses collaborate so that the material that's learned in one course is related to what's being learned in another course. As importantly, they apply pedagogies of engagement, mm-hmm. that is, problem-based learning, project-based learning, cooperative teaching methods. So students not only learn the material together, but they learn it together as groups of students. And the research shows that makes a significant difference in not only student persistence and completion, but learning. Remember, the object of completion is not simply that students complete college, but they learn while doing so.
So the idea is not only that they are sort of in these classrooms together, but it's more organic for them to then form partnerships and relationships outside of the classroom and study together, things like
that's
that.
That's right. We have my colleague Kathy Engstrom and I at Syracuse University studied 21 learning communities across the nation that served low-income students, many of whom needed academic skills. And in those learning communities, especially those that applied cooperative teaching methods or problem-based learning methods, we observed that the students not only spent more time together in class working together, but they spent more time out of class working together. And that is in part why they not only persisted more being part of a community, but learned more and succeeded more rapidly.
So talk about this. The attrition rate is highest in that first year of college, which obviously makes this a critical time. Aside from the fact that, you know, once students have a couple years under their belt, they've invested more time and more money, what makes that first year so important and such a make-or-break moment?
Well, yeah, for a number of reasons, Chris. Recall, many of our students today are first-generation college students. They come from backgrounds like I did when I was much younger. With no family member having experienced college. And for them, going to college is a strange new world. It's like traveling to a foreign country in some ways.
Hmm.
And there's a range of issues about attachment, about adjustment to the demands of academic work, about getting to feel like you're a member of a community, all of which is at risk. So that the first year is in particular important because it establishes a set of conditions like involvement, like knowledge of knowing how to navigate the university and adjusting to learning demands of the college, that really spell the difference for many students of staying or leaving. We know that the majority of students who leave before completion do so in their first year. And then if you look at the second year, many of the students who leave during the second year leave because of their inability to do well in the first year. So there's a reasonable expectation that if we have to start someplace to address the question of completion, we must start in the first year, but not only in the first year.
So lots of colleges and universities have tried to address this problem with these special, they're called freshman seminars, that are designed to help students develop the skills they need and learn to navigate. What do those courses typically cover?
Those courses actually cover a range of things. It all depends on the institution and the types of students served. John Gardner, who's now at Brevard College, sort of the founding father of these freshman success or freshman seminar courses, developed them first as a way of providing advising and counseling to beginning students. Now they have expanded to provide basic skills, study habits, time management. For students who are undecided, they provide advising and career counseling. So they vary. The point of them is that in the first year, many students need to acquire knowledge and skills they do not have for college. And the course is a very effective way of doing so.
So that sounds like a terrific setup, but you have discovered that these freshman seminars work much better if, again, they are directly integrated with the courses that a freshman will be taking.
Yeah, that's true, Chris. And the reason for that has to do with the increasingly known phenomenon of what's called contextualization. That is, when academic support is provided to students, whether it's academic support or social support, that support is much more effective when it's connected to the other demands that students face in the first year curriculum. And the reason why that's the case is that when you connect and contextualize, make relevant that support, it's easier for students to apply the support they receive to do well in the other classes in which they're enrolled. When the freshman seminar is disconnected from everything else, it is regrettably too often the case that students discount the course as not being, quote, an academic course, and they will often ignore it or treat it as a not serious enterprise. So increasingly, institutions are trying to connect that freshman success course to the other courses in which students are also enrolled to help them succeed in those courses as well.
How could you specifically connect those courses?
Well, one of the examples, as you just mentioned, is the learning community. So let's say you have students who start a first-year program. They have two or even three courses they co-register in. That is, they see each other all the time. One of those courses could be the freshman seminar, freshman success course. And the person who teaches that course then collaborates with the other faculty members who are teaching the other courses. And they ask themselves, how can this freshman success course be so organized and run to help students do well in the other courses? That's contextualization.
Vincent Tinto is my guest. He's distinguished professor in the School of Education at Syracuse University and author of Completing College, Rethinking Institutional Action. You can be part of this conversation, maybe talk about your own experiences at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send us email at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Vincent Tinto. He's distinguished professor in the School of Education at Syracuse University and author of the new book, Completing College, Rethinking Institutional Action. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask a question, share a story, our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Vincent, it is your sense that colleges need to rededicate themselves to serving undergraduate students as they try to learn. How can that be achieved without compromising the progress of ongoing academic research that professors still have to get done?
Very good question, Chris. Before I answer that, let me just return to the question about the first-year programs.
Okay.
I want to point out to your listeners that there are a number of very exciting new efforts underway that have recognized the importance of the first year and have actually established coherent first-year programs. For instance, LaGuardia Community College in New York has what's called the First Year Institute for Community College Students, where the entire first year is organized around the central question, how do we help students complete the first year in ways which allow them to succeed after the first year? John Gardner and Betsy Barefoot at Brevard College have an organization called Foundations of Excellence. And they've worked now for the last 5 years helping both 2- and 4-year schools redesign their first-year program entirely because they realize that the first year has to be well-organized to address a range of issues, not just the curriculum. In any case, you want to repeat your question, please?
Yeah, I wanted to ask about if schools are to rededicate themselves to the mission of serving undergraduate students, I would imagine professors will push back and say, but I've got research to do, and that's my priority.
Yeah, I understand that quite well. I come from a research university. But at some point, if we have a social, and I would say moral obligation, to ensure that as we carry out that research, it doesn't come at a price which undermines the ability of students to learn and succeed. So there has to be some balance. And the fact is a number of states are now moving to develop accountability systems in higher education, which actually reward or, if you will, penalize institutions for not improving their rate at which they graduate students, Texas being one of them. So at some point, there has to be a consequence, and that in fact, is beginning to happen. Nevertheless, I think institutional leaderships have to ask themselves, how do we balance the various missions of the university so that all students are able to not only graduate, but learn while they do so? And what is therefore the appropriate balance between research and our obligations to teach? Training the faculty to teach would be one such way.
How important is it to involve faculty members in crafting better strategies for teaching their students, as opposed to, this is something we hear when we talk about sort of public education at the K-12 level, as opposed to sort of a dictum coming down from on high saying, you will now do things this way?
Oh, I understand the difference. There's a saying, if people don't have a voice in constructing programs, why do they get involved? Though it's important for leadership to establish the standards, the expectations, change has to come from the bottom up. And not to do so, in the case of higher education, is to dismiss the faculty as not being caring or qualified. But there has to also be incentives. Given the research demands or the time demands on community college faculty, if the leadership is serious about improving faculty skills, they have to incentivize and make it possible for faculty to acquire those skills. But I'm a strong proponent of the notion, but the faculty then have to devise that system, and they're the ones who have to organize how they go about doing so. But that they should do so is not in question.
Let's go back to this word that you used, expectations, because this is a major theme in your book, and it's something that could easily be overlooked as too obvious. But in fact, the expectations that the university or the college has for the student and the student has for him or herself are vitally important in predicting the success of the students.
Yes, Chris. You well acquainted with that saying, no one rises to low expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Regrettably, the research on this issue doesn't present a happy picture. within the last 10 years, a big national study of four-year colleges carried out by the National Survey of Student Engagement discovered that students who begin four-year colleges enter expecting to do less work to succeed than faculty members would claim that students have to do to succeed.
Hmm.
More tellingly, at the end of the first year, students' expectations for the amount of work they have to do to succeed based upon their experience actually declines.
Wow.
It is telling. And, of course, for those students who come from disadvantaged backgrounds and students of color, they will often say they don't expect us to succeed.
Hmm.
So we really have to be very clear about maintaining high standards for all students. But doing so requires that, in turn, we provide the support necessary to allow students to reach those expectations. Access without support is not opportunity, and expectations without support is holding a false promise.
So what do you mean by support?
Well, support varies. Most typically, we think of support as academic support. That is, if we hold high expectations for performance, we have to make sure that students who enter can obtain the sort of support they need to meet those expectations. And typically they involve academic support. And again, those sort of support systems, like supplemental instruction, like advising systems, like basic skills courses, are more effective when they're literally connected to the actual courses in which students are asked to succeed in the first year. So, for example, there's this wonderful supplemental instruction program at El Camino College. And in many colleges, what they do is for key gateway courses, those are those first-year courses that are required for most students, students will have the option, in some cases are required to attend supplemental study groups.
Hmm.
And these groups of maybe 8 to 10 students are led by a tutor or a faculty staff member or a student's affairs staff member. They would literally work on the assignments of the class each week, 1 week at a time. So students in those classes can receive the sort of support they need to succeed in those classes one class at a time. And that's just the support students need to meet high expectations.
What about the existence in the early years of a college education of so-called weed-out courses? I'm curious as to whether sort of, not doing well in one of those courses simply directs students toward a major that they might be better suited to, or can, you know, failing a class in one's freshman year really feel like they're not suited for college at all?
Well, both apply.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is true that many students enter college with unrealistic expectations of what's required for particular majors, medicine, science, STEM disciplines. So they students need accurate and honest feedback, but they also need the opportunity to succeed in those courses should they so wish. So one has to strike a balance between holding high expectations and understanding that not all students can meet those expectations, but also providing support for those students who need to do so. But you also raise the question of unrealistic expectations about fields of study. A lot of our students enter with no realistic sense of what different fields of study require of their background. And this is where things like orientation programs, in some cases summer bridge programs, or effective advising programs can help students realistically think about the demands of different majors. And that's another area where universities can do much to help students. Some institutions would say that students should not decide a major until the end of the first year.
Hmm.
Of course, many are simply not sufficiently knowledgeable to know what majors make sense given their interests and skills.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with Robin in Wiley. Hi, Robin.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a non-typical student. I started back at the age of 48, and I'm 2 days shy of my 51st birthday.
Wow.
My major is geology, and I plan to become a high school science teacher. So I'm part of the UTeach program at UT Dallas, and a wonderful, amazing program that takes you through how to teach math and science, which is different than teaching anything else.
Hmm.
And so I have a rather interesting contrast that while I am taking courses, I am also watching how the teacher teaches. And in some cases, I can see that their focus is not teaching. But the point I was going to make was the freshman orientation type of courses. I had to go back and take freshman English and government and history and all those freshman courses. And they wanted to put me in a freshman seminar, but when they went over the topics that were going to be covered, it's like, well, I'm 48. I've already made a budget. Mm-hmm. I've had kids. In fact, they're successful adults. So I didn't particularly feel like the topics covered in a freshman orientation seminar were valid for a non-typical student. So I end up finding that there is this contrast between either being ignored because I'm already an adult or being treated like I'm 18, which is tremendously irritating.
Sure. Do you want to comment on any of that, Vincent?
Well, I think you make a good point. The notion of what is a traditional college student clearly has changed. You know, people think of it as they did in the 50s, that these are 18-year-olds going from home to a college and often a residential school. But as you just well pointed out, there's the notion of what's traditional and non-traditional has really changed considerably. And there are many more students like yourself who return to college. That's why this notion of the freshman seminar orientation has to be made specifically for the different students it serves. Students like yourselves often just need a refresher. They need to rethink and remember what they needed to do to succeed and not be put in the same orientation or advising system that brand new students or 18 receive. And that's the obligation of the institution. So I would suggest your institution should rethink its freshman courses, success courses, orientation.
So other key elements of student retention are ongoing assessment and feedback. Talk about the information that is really helpful to students as they progress through, particularly their first and second semesters in college.
Well, one of the important things is to recognize that students need to make adjustments. They come into college often, again, with a various of issues, not least of which is skills. And it helps the students to be assessed frequently within the class, such that information is fed back to faculty and staff so everyone can change and adjust their behaviors. Because adjustment takes time. And the earlier you provide that feedback, what's called early warning systems, if you will, the easier it is for students to adjust. Unfortunately, most freshmen in courses may get a midterm and they may get a final.
Mm-hmm.
And they get a little sort of feedback about what they have to do to improve. Again, this is starting to change. Institutions are starting to invest in what's called early warning systems. So as students receive mini-exams, little quizzes, so that the institution, faculty, staff, and the students themselves knows that they need to get more help early in the course. And the part of that is the longer you wait to provide assessment and feedback and in turn support where needed, the more difficult it is for students to succeed. So students need to get feedback. They need to be assessed. And that's one of the areas we don't do enough in. Now, increasingly, there's real hope in the use of technology in this regard. There is a project that originated from Purdue University called the Signals Project, where all students' first-year mini-exams are given online through an online website. And that feedback is automated, so that students get quick responses automated through all courses. Very effective system.
So in other words, they're literally finding out either they understand this or they don't and what to do about it, whether or not it's tied to a grade.
That's right, Chris. Mm-hmm. But the trick is, I mean, the important part is that that assessment then has to be used to trigger support.
Right.
So it's not just providing a warning saying, now we have to do something about it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Johnny on the line next in Plano. Hey, Johnny.
Hello. Yes, we were speaking earlier about the conflict for professors between teaching and research.
Sure.
And I personally went to a very small liberal arts school where I was a science major, where it was understood that all professors, their primary priority was teaching. Now, so there was zero pressure on them to do research, although some of them did on the side. And I really felt that as a student, we didn't really miss anything by our professors not having that priority of research. So I guess my question then is kind of why in a larger state school setting is that division of labor between research and teaching not as feasible? Thanks.
Oh, good question. You know, part of it has to do with the way in which higher education is organized and the way it thinks of prestige and status and the role of outside research funds in the funding of institutions. The fact is that many of the big research universities put a great deal of stock in the research of their faculty, in the generation of research grants, and the presumption that that provides for prestige of the institution. I quite agree. I don't know if there's any real evidence that people who are full-time in research are any better or worse teachers than those who are not. I think the issue, as I'll repeat, has to do with the ability to know how to convey the knowledge they have. So it is more the professional development of teaching skills and also assessment skills and feedback skills that faculty need at both research and non-research institutions.
We have an email here from Jim who writes, as a high school educator at a Catholic school, what general skills or concepts would you encourage high school seniors teachers to include in their courses that would give seniors a better chance of succeeding at college? And are there skills and concepts you think are overvalued in high school education?
Good question. As regard the first part of that question, there are now, you know, the recognition is now, it's widely accepted that from too many students, their experience in middle and high schools has not well prepared them to college. And that's why so many students enter needing substantial academic support or basic skills, if you will. A number of states have now moved, like California, to start assessing students in the end of the junior year about their ability to enter college without requiring basic skills. And in turn, asking the senior year of high school to be reconfigured to help the students acquire the skills they need before they get into college. So that there's a recognition that the senior year of high school has itself changed to help students.
My guest is Vincent Tinto. He is Distinguished Professor in the School of Education at Syracuse University and author of the new book, Completing College, Rethinking Institutional Action. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Distinguished Professor in the School of Education at Syracuse University, Vincent Tinto. His new book is called Completing College, Rethinking Institutional Action. And Vincent, before the break, you were answering Jim's question about preparing high school students for college before they leave high school. You were saying that the senior year has been or can be reconfigured in a lot of situations. What about the other part of his question, whether or not there are things taught in high school that might be overvalued in terms of preparation for college?
Okay, Chris, let me just, before I answer that, let me go back to the first part of the question.
Okay.
Because I think your listeners should know some of the exciting things occurring in the state of Texas.
All right, great.
There's now the Pathways Project. It is a project involving a collaborative partnership between secondary and post-secondary institutions that is designed to improve the curriculum alignment between high school and post-secondary institutions. This involves a number of community colleges. One that I can think of right off the top is San Antonio Community College in the Alamo Community College District. They've been working with local high schools and collaborating to say that how do we better make what goes on in the high school, especially in the last year, better prepare our students for college. There's a range of community colleges, El Paso, Houston Community Colleges. People should look it up. It's really quite an exciting movement that speaks well of how Texas is approaching the problem. So to the second part, I think that the question of what is unnecessary is hard to determine because there are a lot of skills students acquire that are not immediately or apparently not immediately useful for college, but that doesn't mean they're not useful. I think we need to sit down and really talk out exactly what we want our students in high school to know. Recall, not all high school students go to college. So to have high school be determined solely by college needs is not necessary to all students' advantage. But still, it's a reasonable question, and it's not for me to judge what a high school should do or should not do. But I do think it's recognized that the senior year of high school has not been effectively utilized, and we should think about that as a special year.
Have you observed any difference in the sort of life skills, maybe separate from study and academic skills, that students come to college with if they, assuming that they begin their freshman year, 3 months after the completion of their senior year of high school?
I'm sorry, repeat that, Chris.
I'm wondering if you're finding a change in the life skills that students possess. We've had discussions on this program before about sort of the extension of adolescence based on the way the world works these days and the way parenting works these days. Are there life skills students lack when they arrive at college?
Well, you might want to ask your listener who called in, being an adult student who's nearly 50 going to school.
Mm-hmm.
She would say, yes, it's true. I mean, these are 18. The young people have very little life experience. Many of them have never been outside the high school, been outside their community. And so one could say the whole point of the first year of college is to expose them to larger issues. For example, I am a strong advocate of service learning,
mm-hmm.
Where students not only take courses, but do volunteer work in the community in ways that are connected to their coursework. And I would like to see that all students, before they graduate college, would have a service learning experience. Some people would even argue that students really should do more internships and get more real-life experiences because it's hard to acquire those, quote, real-life skills without having to try doing that work in the real life beyond the high school.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Nikki in Dallas. Hi, Nikki.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to kind of address the idea of dumbing down the curriculum. I am both a high school teacher and somebody who finished a master's degree within the last year. And I'm concerned about the idea that when we try to fit all this project-based learning, problem-based learning, all these extra ideas into a student's finite amount of time in the classroom, what we're doing, in effect, is we're decreasing the amount of information that a professor can put out there. In the master's degree that I just finished, I had a good mixture of experiential classroom experiences and lecture classroom experiences. And the rigor and the difficulty and the amount of information I learned in a lecture-based classroom was just huge in comparison to the amount that I learned in the other classrooms. Did I learn it better or worse? That remains to be seen. But I, as a student, I love getting more, and I got less in those different types of classrooms.
Well, Nikki, you're breaking up a little bit there, but I think we have the gist of your point. Do you want to respond to that, Vincent?
Yeah, I mean, it's an important question. But let me just point out, I think the apparent conflict between process and content is a bit overdone. The important question is, what is the content? What are the ideas or the skills that must be taught? And what skills or content can be acquired by students on their own? So that's one issue. But effective problem-based learning or cooperative teaching or problem-based learning is not the absence of lectures. It's lectures contextualized to the work students have to do to apply what they're learning. I think the issue is just because people listen to content doesn't mean they retain and learn it. The evidence is pretty clear. Applying what you learn is the only way you really retain what you know. We know the students who come to an entire lecture class, though the content may be high at the end of class, you go out a year later and much of that content is forgotten. However, when you look at a class that's interactive, where people do work like problem-based learning or cooperative teaching, though they may have acquired less content, the content they acquired is retained even a year later. So the question really is not what content matters only, But how do we ensure the content is acquired and learned and applied later on?
How important is a student's social life in terms of determining their ability to stay in college and finish?
Oh, it varies. Depends. Remember, first of all, Chris, you well know that many students commute to college. They mm-hmm. often attend part-time. They have family obligations. And so if you mean social experience with their peers after classrooms, these students don't have that experience. They don't have the privilege to spend time on campus. Nevertheless, the social communities they form in the classroom, and for some students who live on campus out of classrooms, matter greatly. And some cases, for students from diverse backgrounds who come from cultures that are different, their social experience on a campus, whether it's supportive or not, can spell the difference of staying or leaving.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Millicent in Fort Worth. Hi, Millicent.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the things that's been touched in a roundabout way is the idea that the students who don't have a prior legacy of college attendance, that they're the first time out, kind of revolves around the idea that perhaps their academic background was minimal, that they weren't prepared for lack of opportunity. What I'm not hearing is the disconnect that can happen between someone who's very well prepared academically, but they don't have the social legacy, and there's the assumption because they do have the academics that they will just figure out how to get all the other resources. The thought is if you're that talented that you will just get through the system and know what's going on. And a lot of it is very much social and not just what classes you took. And if you're academic, you might have placed out of that first year. What can be done for that? I know it's a small demographic, but what can be done for that? Because the retention may not be there either.
Well, I think you raise an important point, and let's just be clear. The label first-generation college student does not necessarily imply that all students are academically prepared, nor does the assumption that people are academically underprepared all first-generation college students. So I think the issue is how does a college identify at the beginning what are the needs of students regardless of the labels we apply to them? And that is why we use orientation, in some cases summer bridge programs, and in many cases first-year advising programs, to make sure that we provide the sort of assistance students need regardless of the labels like first-generation or low-income we apply to them. So I think you make the important point. Not all first-generation college students are unskilled. Many of them are quite skilled. And conversely, not all students from college-educated backgrounds are academically skilled. And that's why early assessment, and that's why institutions need to focus on assessing right at the outset, what are students' needs? And therefore, how do they respond to those needs for those individual students?
What can research universities do to provide incentives and rewards for faculty members who are particularly adept at communicating what they know and inspiring undergraduate students?
Well, I think there's several ways of thinking about that, Chris. One is to make sure our promotion and tenure systems count and value the ability of faculty to help their students learn and grow and graduate. Two, provide incentives and opportunities for faculty to acquire those skills from other faculty who are skilled mm-hmm. Without penalizing their promotion and tenure. That's where institutional commitment matters. It's one thing to talk about these issues. It's another thing for institutions to take seriously the task of improving student success by allocating resources and incentives to do so. And some institutions do, and some do not.
And you say often institutions will commit to this, but then in the long term, they sort of run out of gas in terms of enthusiasm for these programs.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we do see, Chris, is there's a tendency for programs like these things to start and stop, come and go. And part of that is the nature of these fundings for these, quote, retention programs is often the result of soft money acquired from outside the institution. And when that money runs out, the programs cease. So there's another whole effort going on the way, in part, led by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is concerned not with simply starting programs, but how do you sustain and scale them up? The other part of that is scaling up. That is, we see on some campuses a program in one part of the institution, one program. That's remarkable. Students in this program are doing well. But rarely does it scale up across institution. So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has started a project called Completion by Design, involving community colleges in four states, all seeking to ask the question and address the question, how do we sustain programs once started, and how do we scale them up across the campus? That is a continuing challenge for sure.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. I think we'll take a last call. This one's from Doretha in Dallas. Hi, Doretha.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, the discussion is great. I am a lifelong learner, not just by term, but went to school, two masters, I teach additional certifications, and I guess, I don't know if it's my question or my comment, but you guys helped me figure it out. I have started working with student teachers, pre-service teachers, and there is a gap between theory, as we all know, and practical application, which you guys have kind of spoken to in terms of service projects and internships. As I work with a college in revamping their program, because students are not traditional, they have families, they have jobs, they have obligations, how do you suggest, or what do you see coming down the pipes in the future as far as teacher prep programs go?
What do you think, Vincent?
Well, do you mean, I'm sorry, do you mean teacher prep programs preparing college faculty to teach?
Let's get back very quickly, and then we're running out of time. Did you mean college faculty to teach, Doretha, or are you talking about K-12 teachers?
K-12 teachers.
Okay. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not sure I know how to answer that. I think clearly there's increasing focus of K-12 teachers, as there should be in college, on having faculty have the skills so students are actively engaged in the classroom, not passive. And we know active engagement in the classroom, especially with other students in learning activities, promotes greater learning and increases completion. So however we talk about, whether it's secondary or college, we need to get students actively involved and engaged in classrooms. Right now, too much of their experience is passive, too much of it's being a spectator. That's what we need to do, engage our students actively in the classroom, especially in the first year.
The new book by Vincent Tinto is called Completing College, Rethinking Institutional Action. Vincent, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and you can download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. The email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.